Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
We're going to try to cover some material to reinforce some of the things that my father said. Let's start by going through this timeline, because we're going to find out, back page again, we're going to find out the reason that the Jews become vulnerable to Hellenism at the time that they do. Why did it happen then? If, as I said earlier, that this was almost an inevitable kind of a conflict, this was a primordial kind of a forces unleashed in the world, so why did it happen just then? What made the Jews vulnerable to Greece when it happened? That will give us some insight into what strength we have even now to combat that. So going through this timeline, and we're using, because we are Greekified Jews, we're using the calendar dates of the Common Era. So at 370 in the 4th century of the Common Era, 370, after the Babylonian exile, Jews are permitted to return to Israel. Moving on, the Beis HaMikdash begins, but then is aborted because of the evil Shamranim who complained to the emperor and caused the Beis HaMikdash not to be continued. It just starts and stops. 355, we have the story of Purim itself. This is right before the end of the exile, of the Babylonian exile. And we're just trying to put this Hanukkah story into context. Then we have Dayavesh, Esther's son, Darius II, who allows the resumption of the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, of the Second Temple. Meanwhile, the Greeks are on the march, literally. Alexander the Great, in his conquest of the world, defeats the Persian Empire, as in 331. We know that Alexander the Great dies relatively young, and at that point his empire fragments into three large chunks in Egypt, in Syria, and Greece. Israel is right there in between. Judea is right there in between. The Judean Commonwealth is caught in between some of the empire battles that occur. But Alexander the Great, before he dies, has an encounter that's recorded in the Gemara, and is actually recorded as well, almost with the same accuracy, with the same level of detail in Josephus, where he actually meets Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Righteous. Very interesting. My father mentioned Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef the Righteous. There are very few people in Jewish history who get the appellation HaTzadik, and one of them is Shimon, and it's not a coincidence, because Shimon HaTzadik ends up embodying the very power that is going to make the difference in encountering Yavan. And so Alexander the Great, according to the Gemara, ends up having a dream in which he sees a man who later turns out to be Shimon HaTzadik. He doesn't know it's Shimon HaTzadik. He sees this man. He's dressed in these 8 vestments. And the man tells him that he is going to be okay. He's going to be powerful. When Alexander comes through Judea, Shimon HaTzadik, in order to avoid, he's the high priest, he's the Kohen Gadol, in order to avoid having Alexander destroy Yerushalayim, goes out to meet him. And when Alexander sees him, he realizes this is the man of his dreams. This is the man in his dreams. And Alexander bows down to him, which is unheard of. Alexander bows down to the dismay and shock of his own generals. What are you doing bowing down to Simon the Righteous? And he says, I saw this man in a dream, and this is the one who I saw, and therefore I paid him homage. Which ends up presaging the ultimate power that the Jews are going to have over the Greeks, because Shimon HaTzadik embodies something very important. Shimon HaTzadik is Mishiyare Knesset HaGadola. He's of the remnants of the Knesset HaGadola. He's meaning that the Anshei Knesset HaGadola appointed during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash end up being the embodiment, the container, the repository, so to speak, of the tradition of the Mesorah from Sinai. And Shimon HaTzadik is one of the last ones, one of the vestiges of the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. And what do we know about the Anshei Knesset HaGadola? We know that they were the ones who received the transmission of the Torah from the previous group. What does the first Mishnah in Ethics of Our Fathers say? It says, Moshe kibel Torah Mishinah. Moshe received the Torah from Sinai, gave it to Yehoshua. Yehoshua gives it to the Zekanim, to the elders. Zekanim give it to the Nevi'im, to the prophets. And the prophets gave over the tradition, the Mesorah from Sinai, to the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. Now this is a very dramatic change in the way that the Torah is given over. Until this time, you don't have any Torah quoted in the name of a person. We're familiar with Torah quoted in the name of a person. We're familiar with Hu Haya Omer. He used to say. Do you know who the first person is who ever said something, so to speak? Whoever said some Torah that's attributed to him by his name? The first one is Shimon HaTzadik. That's what the Ethics of Our Fathers says at the beginning of the first chapter. Shimon HaTzadik Haya Mikshiri Knesset HaGadola Hu Haya Omer. He was from the remnant of the men of the Great Assembly. He used to say, why don't we have anybody saying anything beforehand that's attributed to them? Because at this point in Jewish history, there's a major transition from one mode of giving over the Torah to the next generation to a different mode. And the mode is a transition from prophecy, where you have human beings in direct communion with God, who actually get communications from the Almighty, and then the prophecy stops, and Anshei Knesset HaGadola, scholars, who devote their lives to absorbing the Torah and to studying the Torah and to reasoning through the Torah and fathoming the depths of the Torah, they become now the repository of the Torah. Now, when someone says something, it's no longer purely the Word of God, meaning it's no longer purely a transmission directly from God. Another prophet would come along and say, so says God. Nobody says, well, I have a different opinion. Once you have the Anshei Knesset HaGadola and you no longer have prophecy, now you have Hu Haya Omer, he would say, because now you have the personality of the individual involved in developing the Torah. So this begins the era during which the Torah Sheba Al Peh, the oral law, becomes a major dimension, a major character, a characteristic in the transmission of Torah. There always was oral law. But the point was, it was handed down without interruption, with total clarity, through generations that had prophets. Now you have human beings struggling valiantly, giving over their lives to understand and interpret the Torah, and now you have the concept of machlokes. You have rabbis arguing, disagreeing with each other, and you have statements attributed to people. These people were great. They were steeped in Torah. They were products of Torah. But there were people working their way through the Torah. This is the era when the Greeks now can invade, so to speak, the minds of the Jewish people. Because now you've got to deal with the wisdom of the Jews versus the wisdom of the Greeks. And this is where the Greeks start making inroads. Until now, there was no question. You're talking about the Torah of God. Now you're talking about the Torah of God, but human beings are responsible for it and are saying things because of their own development, as a result of their own development in Torah. So you have the emergence of machlokes, number one, and meaning difference of opinions within halacha, and number two, you have the attractiveness of human reason, and therefore the Greeks who come along with human reason as a powerful tool in developing and ennobling mankind, they become very attractive to the Jewish people. You know, it's not easy for Jews to give up their heritage. So while we see that the Greeks, they believe in polytheism, they are hedonistic, They are materialistic. Certain strains of Hellenism, not all of it, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we shall die. When we see that, we say, how could the Jews have given up the Torah for that? On the other hand, the Greeks actually were all for contemplation. They were all for the refinement of man. They contributed mightily to what we know as Western civilization. And therefore, they become very attractive to the Jewish people as we move out of the era of prophecy into the era of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. And that encounter between Alexander the Great and Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Righteous, is very telling about the nature of the encounter between the Greeks and the Jews. Now in 245, the Torah is translated into Greek. Now this is a fascinating thing. This is where we get the Septuagint. This is where we get the 70 translations of the Torah. Miraculously, they all are translated, even though they're in 70 different rooms, they all come out to be the same translation, because the Almighty, so to speak, through divine providence, protects the Torah from being misunderstood. They actually have the same deviations in translation where it would be dangerous to have the non-Jewish authorities take note of certain things. This is the day that the Torah is translated, so to speak, is considered to be a minor fast day for the Jewish people, even though at the same time, the Gemara says, the Halacha says, that the only language in which a Torah, other than Hebrew, is kosher is Greek. If a Torah is written in Greek, it is kosher. If it's written in French, it's not kosher. If it's written in Hebrew, missing a letter, it's not kosher. If it's written in Greek properly, it's kosher. What does that tell you about the proximity and the connectiveness, in a certain odd way, that Greece has with Judaism? Because they actually have, why do they want the Torah translated? Because they have a respect and a reverence for chachma, for wisdom. And at first, when they encountered the Jewish people, they had a very unusual experience, the Greeks. They had never had a civilization that they had conquered that had resisted their own culture. The Greeks felt that they were benevolently spreading wisdom to the entire human race. And here they come to the Jews, and the Jews continue to maintain their own tradition. And so the Greeks say, we're going to translate the Torah, because we respect all kinds of wisdom. We respect your wisdom. We expect you to respect our wisdom. And so, as the Torah is translated, it implies a respect that the Yevanim have for the written Torah. We're going to get to this in a minute, to the oral Torah, for the written Torah. But at the same time, it also conveys an appreciation that the Jewish people have for the pursuit of wisdom and beauty that Yavan itself undertakes. So, in the short time I have, I just want to summarize a couple of very important issues so that we can get a sense of the power of Hanukkah and why it's still relevant to us now. So, my father mentioned before the concept of Shemen. So, let me show you a couple of things here. Here's shemen in Hebrew. Okay, shemen, oil. My father mentioned that if you add the hay to it, you end up with the word, with the number shmona, which is 8. If you jumble these words, what do you get? You get Mishnah. What is a Mishnah? Mishnah is a codification of the oral law. What else do you have when you jumble these letters? Neshama. Exactly, neshama. And very superficially but accurately, we could say that the Mishnah, the oral law, is the neshama, is the soul of the Jewish people. Because what the Mishnah does is it gives life to the skeleton of the written Torah. The Greeks have tremendous reverence for the written Torah. They translate it. They want to know what it says. Give us more wisdom. We love wisdom. But that's where it stops. They don't want the oral law. They don't want the neshama. There is no neshama. You can't see a neshama. You can't see a soul. All there is whatever is written. Hard facts. Hard stories. Hard legends. Insights. That the Greeks can relate to. But they can't relate to the oral law. The oral law is actually the device that God uses to create a submission to the authority of the Torah itself. Because what is oral law? We don't even realize what oral law is. We think of oral law really as a book called the Gemara, the Talmud, and the Mishnah. The oral law is a student going to a Rebbe, to a master, and a Rebbe is a master, and saying, please teach me what you have absorbed from the previous generation, that was absorbed from the previous generation, that connects me to Sinai. The whole point of the oral law is that it's not just a book that you open. A book doesn't connect you to anything. A book is whatever, you can do the book yourself. You read the book. You just read the words. The only way the book connects you to God is if the book requires something else with it to connect you to the author, which is the oral law, the partnership of the oral law to the written law. The Greeks want to divorce the oral law from the written law. They respect the written. There's the Torah. You have it. You have it. You have a source of wisdom. It's only the Jews who have a relationship to God through submitting to the authority of the master who is in possession, so to speak, of the Masorah, of the tradition, all the way back to Sinai. So you start to get an idea of why it is that in Jewish tradition we say that Hanukkah is actually a celebration of the victory of Torah Shaba'al Peh, oral law, and the embracing by the Jewish people of the oral law. That's why the menorah stands for the light of the Torah. The light of the Torah broadcast and exemplified by the oral law. So that's one of the sources of our strength against Yavan is actually the embracing of the oral law. Now, hear how this traces itself through Jewish thought. Talmud says, for example, that the Torah is only maintained in somebody who puts himself to death over it. Ein haTorah miskayemes ela b'misha meimis atzmo aleha. The Torah is only maintained by somebody who's willing to die for it. Meaning, it's not the book where you kick up your feet, you lie down in bed, you read a few pages, you enjoy it. This is really neat stuff, you know? That's not how it works. The only way a person becomes steeped in Torah is by really breaking his back on it. Pas b'mayim tochal, you're going to eat bread and water, al ha'aretz tishan, you're going to sleep on the ground. You're going to give your entire being over to it. If you do that, you're going to be able to absorb the Torah. That's not Greek. The Greeks don't believe that at all. The Greeks don't believe that you in any way annihilate or minimize the body in order to absorb a higher wisdom. The Greeks understand that your body will give you all of the wisdom necessary through your mind, through thinking, but you're not in any way going to work yourself to death in order to get wisdom, because that would be annihilating wisdom, because according to the Greeks, it is your physical self that is all there is. There's nothing else. But we Jews understand that there's actually a connection to the Almighty, and that's going to come through Torah Shaba'al Peh, through the oral law. My father mentioned this Yavan, this interesting shaping of Yavan. And not all of you can see it over there, but the progression. My father called it symmetrical. You can also see a progression. There's a short line, a longer line, and an even longer line. If I asked you what was going to come after that, what would you tell me? You would tell me an even longer line, right? Because, which means there's something very predictable about Yavan. Whatever you see is what's going to tell you what's there. And if you so from Yavan's entire being is, I'll be able to figure this out. We have a different idea of beauty. My father alluded to it. When we say, when we talk about Sion, we say, Yafei Nof Mesos Kol Ha'aretz. Sion, Zion, is the beauty of the entire world. The sages say that there were 10 measures of beauty that were given to the world. 9 are given to Yerushalayim and 1 to the rest of the world. Did the sages ever see the Grand Canyon? I mean, did they ever see any of the other, did they ever see the Swiss Alps? I mean, Yerushalayim's nice, but come on. Really. I mean, just you know, go and Google images. There's a lot of stuff out there, and it's really breathtaking. So are they just partial to the Jewish people? The answer is that when we talk about beauty, we're talking about access to the spiritual source of the world. And the sages, when they stood in Yerushalayim, they were not looking through the windows of a tour bus. They were looking through the windows of the Jewish soul. They were looking at the source of being. That's what Sion is. When you take the righteous person, the tzaddik, and you put it in front of Yavon, you get Sion. Let's see how we got that. Yeah, you get Sion, exactly. So you take the tzaddik, which means you take the devotion to spiritual perfection, to the perfection of the neshama. You put that in front of Yavon, you get Sion. That's the Jewish idea of beauty. And by the way, Sion and Yosef happen to equal the same number, 156. If you add it up. The point is that the Jew is devoted to the development of the soul, to the transcendence of the soul over the body, to the use of the body by the soul. That's the harmony of the Jewish people. The Greeks refused to even admit the presence of the soul. And so just to summarize, the basic differences in this conflict between the Jews. So first of all, we start with Hashem Echad. God is one. He's the source of everything. He's the creator, as my father mentioned before. Not only is he the creator, he's involved with the world now. Not only did he make the world, but he didn't go away. He's involved with the world now. The Hellenists said that the world always existed. There was no creator. Nature is a constant. And the gods of Hellenistic philosophy, they're actually of the world. They are actually... They actually have the same faults as human beings. I think the Greek gods they're jealous of each other. They have love and passion. When there's trouble in the world because the gods aren't getting along, they impose because the gods of the Greeks are created by human beings, whereas in Jewish thought, lahavdil, our goal is to imitate God. In Greek thought, the gods imitate human beings. And as we mentioned before, beauty. To the Greeks, beauty was an ideal. What you see is what there is, and the human body is the ultimate. By the way, the word gymnasium comes from a Greek word which means naked, because not only do they compete, and not only did they set up gymnasium in every country, in every city that they conquered, and there was one, by the way, set up next to the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim during the time that the Greeks imposed themselves on the Jews before the rebellion. They were naked. So it's very interesting. You have a civilization that is the refinement, so to speak, the ultimate in refinement in human thought. That's the basis of Western civilization, the basis of philosophy, the basis of democracy, the basis of art and mathematics and physics. That same society, Plato himself, advocated male-child sex. There's no other way to say it. That same society had people defecating in public, in open toilets with no walls, because everything physical was worthwhile to appreciate, and there was nothing to hide. There was no shame whatsoever. There was nothing at all that anybody had to cover up in terms of the body. So to the Greeks, beauty is the ideal. To us, beauty leads to God. Isha yiras Hashem hitisalo. The woman who fears God, she shall be praised. The idea is that whatever we see in the world, we want to see what's behind it. We want to lead ourselves back to the Almighty. So that's really the struggle that goes on between Judaism and Hellenism, and as we certainly sense, it still exists even to this day. And our response on Hanukkah is, as my father mentioned earlier, Hallel v'Hodah, praise and acknowledgement, because what we're doing is we're saying that whatever we see, we know you're behind it. Whatever we see, we acknowledge. We are humble before you. And therefore, when the sages established Hanukkah, they established Hanukkah to provide the tool that will be useful for the Jewish people to endure the continued onslaught of the Greek exile, which is in here. The Greek exile is in here. It's not out there. I'm not moving anywhere, as we said earlier. But when the sages established Hanukkah, they actually established a Yom Tov that would provide the tools for us to be able to win the battle against the philosophy of Hellenism, which still pervades the world. All right. Thank you very much for your attention. Yossi, you might have a burning question like the light of the menorah. Yes. Yes. Very good. Okay. I'm going to thank you, Yossi. Yossi mentions that Yavan looks like the beginning of the word Yonah or Yon, which is a. So we're not going to answer that, but isn't that interesting? Where is the first dove in the Torah? Where is the first dove in the Torah? Noah. What do we know about that dove? What does he bring back? Olive leaf. Olive oil, olive leaf. There you have, right from the beginning, Yavan, Yonah, oil is a relationship. There's more. All right, there's a lot to talk about there. Thank you, Yossi. We just scratched the surface. Okay.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.